atrocities in Yemen. It marked the first time in the Council's 15-year history that a resolution was defeated. Ahead of the vote, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said there was no peace in sight in Yemen and that urgent funding was needed to avert large-scale famine there. Meanwhile, the Dutch ambassador called the vote a major setback, adding that the Council failed the Yemeni people and cut their lifeline to the international community. Rights activists had previously warned that Riyadh was heavily lobbying against the resolution in a blatant attempt to ensure blanket impunity for crimes and other violations of international law in Yemen. They also accused the UNHRC of bowing to Saudi pressure and putting politics before principle. Experts believe the Council has lost its credibility by shutting down the investigation.
UN Human Rights Council has lost any credibility it once had, and that was marginal anyway. But by shutting down an investigation into atrocities committed in Yemen, this is something that is clear to anybody that horrendous things are happening in Yemen. And the fact that some other countries have strong-armed those council members to vote against this is just politics, but it's corruption, and it's tragic for the people of Yemen.
This is not the first time Saudi Arabia has used what many call arm twisting to stop the UN from scrutinizing the Yemen war. Back in 2016, Saudi Arabia was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its 7-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh, but the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. And political commentator and peace activist, Brian Terrell, out of Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off with Zafar out of Toronto. Isn't even saying that investigations will be stopped into possible war crimes ironic to begin with? I mean, when there have been so many civilians killed, shouldn't it be obvious that war crimes have been committed?
Well, absolutely. I think the manner in which the UN Human Rights Council has acted is absolutely scandalous when it is well known and well established that at least 100,000 people have been killed in Yemen since March of 2015 when the Saudis launched their murderous assault on that poorest of countries in the Middle East. And more than a million children are suffering from cholera. The UN agencies themselves have said that the vast majority of the Yemeni people are on the verge of starvation. And for the UN Human Rights Council now to vote to end the investigation into Saudi crimes is absolutely scandalous. I think we also need to keep in mind that the Saudi regime has an atrocious record even at home. There are tens of thousands of political prisoners in Saudi Arabia. Dissidents are murdered, they are shot to death, they are executed. All kinds of other oppressions are taking place inside Saudi Arabia. But in terms of its crimes in Yemen, I think it is well established. I mean, the UN itself has said that there have been hundreds of thousands of casualties over there. The UN itself has said that there is mass starvation, that children are suffering terribly. So to stop this investigation into Saudi war crimes makes a mockery of the UN Human Rights Council and the manner in which it conducts its business.
Well, Brian, Yemen has actually just commemorated an attack on a funeral procession 5 years ago where over 100 people were killed. How can the Saudis get away with that and such an act not be considered a war crime?
Well, it is certainly that was one crime of many, and I think what it comes down to is the U.S. and other Western countries, the arms manufacturers, are making a lot of money off of this, and a investigation into the war crimes is inconvenient, you know, to those. A year ago, earlier this year, when it appeared that the United States, President Biden, was talking about cutting off the weapons flow to the Saudis, and the CEO of Raytheon Corporation told his stockholders, peace is not going to break out anytime soon in the Middle East, and we will continue to see this an area of continued growth. I think it's also the politics involved is a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, Saudi Arabia tried to get a seat on this very council, the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, and was defeated. But the bid to stop this investigation was led by the ambassador from Bahrain, and I've been to Bahrain and. To say that Bahrain, the Hamad monarchy in Bahrain is a government for the people of Bahrain with their welfare and interests at heart is really absurd. It really is. It's a Saudi proxy, and this is how the Saudis have been able to do this. They really do have a seat on this council, only it's named after the Kingdom of Bahrain.
Well, Zafar, why haven't we seen more intervention to stop the carnage by the Saudi regime in Yemen from the so-called international community again?
Well, basically, as Brian pointed out, it has a lot to do with the sale of weapons, and Saudi Arabia is the largest importer of weapons in the Middle East by far, and in fact, even in terms of weapons imports worldwide, Saudi Arabia is right there at the top. And we need to keep in mind that in weapons sales, the returns on profits is enormous. And so the weapons manufacturers want to encourage more wars so that their weapons are sold, so that they can their weapons are used, so that they can sell more weapons. And so wars for them is a profitable business. And that's why we see that around the world, countries like the United States, Britain, France, other weapons manufacturers are very happy to see these wars continue, even when the Saudis are perpetrating horrific crimes. And we also need to keep in mind that these Western countries are also guilty of war crimes, just as the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine is. And you know, let's remember back in earlier this year, the International Criminal Court actually said that they have the right to to investigate Israeli crimes against the Palestinians. And when the ICC chief prosecutor was changed in June, because her term ended in June, and a new chief prosecutor came on board, this matter against the Zionist regime has gone silent. So we see that not only the Saudi crimes in Yemen, but the Western regimes themselves are guilty of horrendous crimes against humanity, and therefore they're not going to push for any investigation of Saudi crimes. The only time they push for any investigations is if there is a government or a ruler that is, that does not toe the American line, then they go after such a government or particular ruler, and they try to haul that particular ruler before the International Criminal Court. So in this case, we see that there are definitely double standards being applied. I don't think that there is any doubt in the minds of anybody that Saudi Arabia is a gross violator of human rights. It has committed war crimes in Yemen. But unfortunately, there are countries around the world, Western countries, that are quite happy supplying it weapons, and they want to shield the Saudi regime from any criticism or any investigation that would haul these criminals or the bring these criminals to justice.
Ryan, what do you make of what Zafar just said? So if the case is so that these many of these Western governments are also involved in war crimes, whether in Yemen or other places, and continue to basically shield Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, isn't the whole concept then of a United Nations Human Rights Council, and even perhaps the United Nations itself, when these countries have so much power on a committee like that, or in the United Nations itself, like the Security Council, I mean, at the end of the day, what does it really do if these countries are also complicit?
You know, this instance calls to mind just a couple of years ago, the International Criminal Court was investigating the United States for war crimes in Afghanistan, and the United States responded by putting sanctions against the investigators. So yeah, the Dutch ambassador has said, rightly, that the council has failed the people of Yemen, and in the most immediate sense, that's true, where you have 18 million people facing starvation in the very near term. But in the broader sense, this has failed the people of the world, and as has been mentioned, this UN Human Rights Council has had very little credibility. But what credibility it has really it is lost, and it's tragic for people who are looking for the people of the world, who are looking for ways that to solve problems through diplomacy, but of course diplomacy doesn't bring in a lot of cash for the arms manufacturers, who really are more than our governments, more than our kingdoms and legislators, and more than the United Nations, setting policy and setting the course of the world.
Safar, do you think that if Washington ordered Riyadh to stop the war today, that it could end today?
Oh, absolutely. The United States exercises enormous influence for a number of reasons. As you know, you mentioned in your earlier question that it has a very, very large say in the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council basically is a body in which five permanent members dictate to the rest of the world. And so they can get away literally with crimes and murder, and nobody can touch them. If, for instance, the United States wanted to stop this horrendous war in Yemen and stop these war crimes from being committed in Yemen, it could do so, because the United States is supporting the Saudi regime. It is providing intelligence information. It is, in fact, providing identifying targets for the Saudis to hit, although the Saudis are so incompetent that they often fail to hit military targets, and they target civilian populations, schools, hospitals, grain depots, and so on. The list is endless. I mean, the number of crimes that the Saudis have perpetrated in Yemen is absolutely horrendous. It is well known. It is well documented. The only people that are basically shying away from it is the UN Human Rights Council, under pressure from the Western regimes, because the Western regimes themselves are complicit in these crimes. We need to remember that since 9/11, the United States and its allies have murdered an estimated 32 million people worldwide. You can take Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Libya and Syria, Lebanon, Somalia, Mali at the present time. In all of these countries, horrendous crimes are being perpetrated by the Western regimes. And this is well documented. This is not something, this is an Australian professor who did the analysis, and he came up with the figure of 32 million, largely civilians, killed over the last 20 years. So what we are witnessing is that worldwide, all of these regimes are perpetrating these horrific crimes. And so in that sense, they are complicit in the Saudi crimes in Yemen as well. And that is why the U.S., although it has the power and the authority to stop these crimes, it doesn't want to do so, as we mentioned earlier, because if the war in Yemen ended, then who's going to be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia? The Saudis would not need any more weapons. And so it has to do with selling weapons, it has to do with Saudi Arabia serving as a cash cow, and it has to do with keeping that entire Middle East region unstable so that the Zionist regime can continue to maintain its hegemony and the people of the region, that is the Middle East, continue to pay a very, very heavy price.
You just made interesting points, Zahra and Bryant. So if it is the case, as Zahra has said, that obviously Washington could make this war in. So is it in the U.S.'s strategic interest to keep this war going? I mean, Zafar just talked about, and you also mentioned about, as for selling arms. But at the end of the day, does it help the United States strategically to continue this war against Yemen?
No, it doesn't help the people of the United States. It doesn't help what really are U.S. interests. What it helps is the arms industry, and it's the people of the United States in various ways, not as dramatically immediately as the people of Yemen. But we're in a country with a decaying infrastructure. We have we are the industrialized country with the most inept healthcare, education system. Things are falling apart here because of the same thing. This is not helping the United States. It's helping the corporations that own the politicians. So no, it's not in anyone's interest. And I think the United States really ought to, at this point, with the challenge of climate change, ought to be thinking about other options rather than. Using our own shale oil that was considered too dirty to process only a few years ago, or trying to control the oil flow out of the Middle East. We need to be finding alternatives, and that would be to the interests of the United States, of its people, but it would be very hard on the arms manufacturers and the U.S. Based petroleum industry.
Well, Zafar, we have seen the Yemenis be resilient in fighting back and trying to resist the Saudi-led onslaught. Do you think that the more the Yemenis feel that injustice is being waged against them by the Saudis and their supporters, the more defiant the Yemenis have become?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the people of Yemen have demonstrated over the last 6.5 years or so that they will not tolerate foreign aggression. They have shown remarkable resilience despite the fact that they are extremely poor. They have paid a very heavy price, but they are now hitting back. And I think this is something that we need to look at in the broader context, in the sense that when people are under oppression, when people are getting killed, they are being bombed, crimes are being committed against them, they are left with absolutely no choice but to fight back. And I think in case of Yemen, and we saw earlier in Afghanistan as well, where the the people fought against the U.S. and its allies for 20 years, ultimately driving the U.S. out of Afghanistan, although it cost the U.S. $2.26 trillion, and all of that money has gone down the drain. But in case of Yemen, the Yemenis are putting up a very stiff resistance, and they're also targeting vital military installations inside Saudi Arabia. And I think that the time is getting closer when the Yemenis would be able to get rid of this Saudi aggression, to defeat the Saudi aggressors completely, and perhaps even as a bonus to get rid of the ruling corrupt Saudi family, because they have been a bane not only for the people of Saudi Arabia, but virtually the entire Muslim world. And so that day, we hope, is sooner rather than later. But definitely, we salute the Yemeni people for their courageous resistance in the face of enormous odds.
On that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on the Spotlight, the Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell out of Molloy, Iowa. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about Nazr, or giving food and charity to the poor and the like, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Jawid, we are talking about the laws according to vows and oath. We started it, in fact, in the late part of the previous program. Here in this program, Islamic Laws on Arabic English Radio. Let me start this episode with the conditions for the validity of an oath. Because we talked about I asked you a couple of questions related to oath and the differences between vows, oath, and contract or covenant or act, all right? Would you tell our dear audience about the conditions for the validity of an oath?
Well, a person who takes an oath should be, first of all, baligh. You know, he should be adult, he should have attained the age of puberty. And of course, he should be sane as well, sane. And he should make or take the oath with free will.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with clear intention.
Yes.
If one of these conditions are not fulfilled, then of course the oath is not binding. Therefore, If an oath is taken by a minor or an innocent person or a person who is coerced or forced into taking an oath, that oath is not going to be binding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much important that the oath is taken voluntarily and intentionally and, of course, volitionally. That's important. This is the first condition, you know. And then there is another condition. The oath that is taken to perform by a person to perform a haram act is invalid.
Mm-hmm.
And also if a person takes an oath to avoid or to just abandon an act which is essentially obligatory, again, it's not valid. Okay, that act which a person takes oath about must be obligatory. For example,
right.
If he should do it should be something which is permissible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not obligatory. It should be something allowable, mubah. Otherwise, the oath is not going to be binding and it's not going to be valid as well. For example, if a person takes an oath for renouncing a usually permissible act, it will be valid, okay, a usually act permissible. But if a person takes an oath to do something haram, or to avoid which something which is obligatory, that oath is absolutely invalid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is another thing that His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei has added. He says that the oath must be sworn by one of those names of Almighty Allah, you know, names which are exclusively for Allah.
I see.
Now, for example, Allah is the only name, then the name which is given and which is exclusive to God, okay? Allah.
Yes, sure.
But if there is any other name which is also used exclusively for Allah, like, for example, Raziq, we have no one and no other creature in the world which is that could be Raziq.
Mm-hmm.
So Raziq is an attribute of Allah. Or sustainer, okay,
yes.
Sustainer. And also, there is another attribute which we say Khaliq, for example. Khaliq.
Right.
There is no one other than Allah to be Khaliq. So if a person takes an oath using one of these names, okay?
Yes.
One of these names, it will be valid. But if a person...
So the inclusion of such exclusive words of God is necessary.
Necessary, of course. If a person, let's say, uses a word which can be used both for people as well as for God, like, for example, sani', okay?
Yes.
Sani', a carpenter is also a sani',
mm-hmm.
okay? God is also sani'.
So it's common.
It's common. And if a person takes an oath using this attribute of Allah, then of course it's not going to be binding. It's
right.
very important.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's another condition. The oath should be uttered in words, okay?
Yes.
And if a person just makes the intention and says, okay, he forms the intention, but he does not verbally say it, that oath is not going to be binding.
I
okay.
See.
You would say, okay, what should a dumb person do? A person who is unable to speak, can he take an oath? Of course, he can make gestures. He can make signs.
Body language.
Yeah, body language is there.
Or sign language.
In that case, of course, because he's unable to speak, so he can, through body language, make that oath, and he can, of course, take that oath, and the oath is going to be binding. And then there's also another condition. The person who takes an oath takes an oath should be in a position to fulfill that that act. For example, it should be possible for him to act upon his oath, okay? And if he, for example, was able to act upon the oath at the time when he was capable,
yes,
but he did not do it, and later on he became incapable, or then of course because he's now incapable, he is not supposed to do it because
mm-hmm.
he's now incapacitated,
yes,
and he should take his own capacity, his own ability into consideration. If he takes an oath to do something which is beyond his capacity, that oath is not going to be binding.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our discussion on the laws of oath.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the laws according to Ayatollah Khamenei on oath now, and you were Sheikh Javi talking about the conditions for the validity of the oath, alright?
Yes.
Just very quickly, I just wanted to squeeze in a very quick question, and that is the use of the holy scriptures like the Quran. Is it necessary, indispensable to use the Holy Quran, in fact, to put your hand on and take an oath?
Well, generally people put their hand on the Quran, but you know there is nothing on the religious literature to indicate that such a thing is a requirement.
I see.
To be fulfilled while taking an oath.
Yes.
You know, because the Quran is the holiest book, people, in order to reassure the other side, put their hands on the Quran and make that, take that oath, but it's not a part of the oath. In order for oath to be binding, a person should utter God's name.
Yes.
And make that and take that oath.
Okay.
So if a person only puts his hand on the Quran and says nothing, that's not going to be an oath.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it's not binding as well.
Yes, okay. Can a father nullify the oath of a child, or a husband nullify the oath of, like, the wife, for example?
That's a good question. Of course, a husband can nullify the oath of his wife, because, of course, the wife is supposed to be maintained and provided for by the by the husband.
Yes.
And, of course, she cannot make an oath or take an oath without the permission and consent of the of her husband. And, of course, if he takes an oath with the permission of her husband, then that oath is going to be binding.
Yes.
And if later the husband wants to nullify it, he cannot nullify it,
mm-hmm.
because he gave his permission in the first place.
Yes.
Now he wants to nullify it, he cannot do it, and that oath is going to be binding. When it comes to a child, of course the father can nullify the oath of his son, and he is allowed to do so.
I see. Very quickly, sir, if a person does not act upon his oath because of forgetfulness, helplessness, or heedlessness, does he have to give kafara?
Well, in the state of helplessness and forgetfulness, of course, person is not supposed to do anything, and
mm-hmm.
And there's no kafara because of being forgetful. A forgetful person is excused. A helpless person is actually excused, and he is not supposed to give any kafara. The same is the case with the person who is being a little bit carefree or heedless to some extent. Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that, okay, such a person does not have to give kafara. But if a person out of, you know, deliberate violation, let's say deliberate intention or intentional decision, or let's say what goes against the oath and violates that oath, then kafara becomes payable. He has to comply.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Chow. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pariza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The olive harvest season has started in the occupied Palestinian territories, but instead of being a festive season, it's been overshadowed by the sporadic attacks by Israeli settlers like previous years. We visited the village of Al-Mghayyar, northeast of the occupied Ramallah, where Israeli settlers vandalized over 100 olive trees a while ago. One of the landowners told us that settler attacks on the groves have escalated during the autumn harvesting season.
The settlers do whatever in their power to prevent us from harvesting. They till our crops, destroy our lands, and sometimes burn our trees. They try to keep us away from our lands. 2 days ago, over 100 olive trees were destroyed. The settlers are protected by Israeli forces.
As Palestinian farmers here and other villages suffer an almost daily act of aggression by Israeli settlers, a popular campaign called Faza has been launched to protect farmers. These areas are considered to be at high risk of settler attacks during the harvest season. Supported by the Committee Against the Woolland Settlement, the campaign has attracted volunteers including university students, farming committees, local councils, and residents of the villages.
Every year, Palestinian farmers come under attack by the settlers in areas close to Israeli settlements. We have come to Al-Mughayyar village to help Palestinian farmers in harvesting their products as quickly as possible and protect them against settler attacks.
Al-Mughayyar is surrounded by a number of settlements. Israeli settlers attack Palestinian farmers on a daily basis, but when we appear in groups, our farmers feel safer and the settlers won't dare to attack them.
The vandalism by the extremist settlers have persisted year after year during the olive harvest season in recent years. Observers say these settlements have been set up to encircle Palestinian areas to make life harder for Palestinians.
Olive harvest has never been easy for Palestinian families living close to Israeli settlements. Olive harvest is considered by many of them as a way to stay connected to their land and protect it against the Israelis. This land has been a source of food and income for Palestinian families for generations. Mona Qandil, Al-Mughayyar village, northeast of occupied Ramallah.
From the 2019 anti-government protests in Lebanon to the 2020 explosion in Beirut port, the documentary delves into the heart of the historic incidents to shed light on the truth. Directed by Lebanese filmmaker Sahar Hossein Ghaddar, the feature documentary was premiered in Tehran. Over the course of the filmmaking, Sahar attended the 2019 nationwide protests, which she says were sparked by economic mismanagement and corruption, but were wrongly portrayed to be against the resistance movement.
The 2019 demonstrations were born out of people's pain and hardship and sought to put an end to 3 decades of corruption entrenched in the ruling system in Lebanon. People from all walks of life, including supporters of the resistance movement, were among the protesters. But Israeli opportunists tried to hijack the protest and say that the demonstrations were triggered by anti-Hezbollah sentiments.
The documentary also reviews the August 2020 blast at the port of Beirut, which killed 219 people. No one has yet been charged in the 14-month probe into the incident. However, Hezbollah has been critical of Judge Tariq Bitar for weeks, accusing him of singling out Hezbollah-affiliated politicians for questioning over the explosion. Last week, 6 pro-Hezbollah protesters were shot dead by anonymous gunmen during a demonstration by resistance groups who called the investigation politicized and demanded the removal of Judge Bitar.
Israeli footprints can be traced in the case that investigates the Beirut explosion. Israel and the U.S. seize any chance to deal a blow to our country and the resistance axis. What Mr. Bitar is doing serves the interest of our Israeli and American enemies by trying in vain to implicate Hezbollah in the Beirut port blast. And we saw a few days ago that our peaceful protests against Bitar were faced by sniper bullets shot by a Lebanese forces faction from a Christian neighborhood.
Last year's port blast happened after a fire detonated nearly 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate, a combustible chemical widely used as agricultural fertilizer that had been stored unsafely in a port warehouse for almost 6 years. Based on information provided in the documentary, senior Lebanese officials were aware of the material's existence and the danger it posed, but failed to secure remove or destroy it.
The documentarian says her film tries to expose what she calls a string of lies that seeks to smear the resistance axis. She says that string is pulled by Israel, stressing that she and her fellow Lebanese youth demand a strong government and judicial system that are independent of Israeli manipulation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Anger boiling on the streets of Karachi. People have come together to denounce the recent deadly attacks on two Shia mosques in the neighboring Afghanistan, Kunduz and Kandahar, that took the lives of over 100 worshippers. Protesters are outraged at what they call the global powers' failure in Afghanistan that led to the chaos and instability there. They say those powers are responsible for the recent bloodshed in the war-torn Afghanistan. Protesters chant anti-Israel and anti-US slogans and stress the need for unity among Muslims.
We were martyred in mosques, we were martyred on roads and processions, but we never backed off from our stance of following the footsteps of Hussein ibn Ali. It is the responsibility of Kabul government to provide security to Shia Muslims in Afghanistan, otherwise Taliban government can never get away with global criticism.
Fear looms large that the government in Kabul is unable to curb terrorist groups like Daesh terrorist group, who has claimed the attacks.
We are here to show solidarity with our brothers and sisters whose loved one became the victims of brutal terror attacks in Kunduz and Kandahar Shia mosques in last two Friday prayers. U.S. shameful withdrawal from Afghanistan brought us to this day, where our brothers and sisters are not safe.
Protesters also called on the Pakistani government to take up issue with the Afghan government. They said the international community should not remain silent towards the crimes being committed against Shia people of Afghanistan. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Following fierce clashes with the Saudi-led coalition's forces and terrorist groups, Yemen's armed forces successfully liberated 3,200 square kilometers in Marib and Shabwa provinces, Bayhan, Ain and Usaylan directorates of Shabwa, as well as Abdiya and Harib of Marib were liberated during the operation named Spring of Victory.
Our armed forces have managed to accomplish a Spring of Victory operation in the Marib and Shabwa governorates and achieve their goals. By the operation, the army liberated vast areas amounting to thousands of square kilometers.
Yemeni officials say the recent victory was made in two strategic provinces with the cooperation of tribesmen in most of the liberated areas.
The significance of the operation lies in the importance of the two governorates in which the battle took place, namely Marib and Shabwa, which are oil-rich and strategic. This operation will have a direct impact on the Saudi-led coalition. The tribesmen played an unprecedented role in liberating these areas.
Earlier, the spokesman of the Yemeni army had announced that the armed forces liberated 600 square kilometers in the oil-rich province of Marib.
Vast areas in Marib and Shabwa provinces have been captured by the Yemeni army, which means that the armed forces will go further in their efforts to liberate the eastern Shabwa province after liberating the whole province of Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Kandahar mosque blast was the deadliest incident since the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in August. It was the second week in a row that a Shia mosque came under an attack claimed by Daesh terrorist group.
I
think Daesh attacks must be considered as crimes against humanity. They kill hundreds without being held accountable. The perpetrators are Takfiri terrorist groups and the enemies of Afghanistan and Islam. Taliban, as a new ruler, should maintain security, not only for their officials, but also for citizens.
Recent bomb attacks that targeted our innocent people have no place in Islam. They are misusing Islam's name. The government should take decisive measures and bring those responsible to justice.
Observers see the attacks as part of a larger plot to sow seditions between Muslim brothers in Afghanistan. They add that there are hands-off intelligence agencies and countries behind these divisive plots.
Being defeated in Iraq and Syria, the Daesh terrorist group is taking revenge on Afghan Shias. Also, the US is seeking revenge for its defeat in Afghanistan.
Kandahar attacks comes in line of a series of attacks targeting the unity of Afghan Muslims. Moreover, the most important point about these attacks is that the US is trying to create tensions in the region to involve Iran, India, and Russia in an unwanted war.
The Afghanistan Shia Clerics Council condemned the attack and urged the Taliban government to take action against Daesh and fulfill their promises. Shia clerics called for further unity and solidarity among all Muslims.
The recent daily bomb blasts have caused a wave of shock among Afghans, especially in big cities. Many here say they now expect the Taliban to put an end to the terror attacks by Daesh and establish security in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's most repressed political group, the Yellow Vests, have just premiered what they are calling Season 2. In some 300 cities and towns, they have planned to demonstrate in mass numbers for the first time in more than 1.5 years due to the coronavirus restrictions. 3 years ago, the Yellow Vests first donned the reflective protective gear required in French cars to protest regressive gas tax hikes amid record petrol prices. This week, energy costs hit all-time highs in multiple areas.
After 3 years, nothing has changed, except for the fact that things have gotten even worse for the average French person. Life has gotten so much more expensive, but Macron doesn't even care. He doesn't see the demands of the Yellow Vests, or even the French people, as worthy of his attention.
The Yellow Vests were not only the biggest, essentially class-based political movement in the Western 21st century, but they were also incredibly popular. 30 other countries started their own Yellow Vest movements. French polls showed them consistently around a 60% approval rating, and that's despite a constant mainstream media campaign against them. They were falsely smeared with charges of xenophobia, but they held marches against anti-Semitism, while their Paris demonstration was led by a banner of a Muslim woman wearing a hijab. President Emmanuel Macron's hardline policy against them provoked international condemnation.
From November 2018 until June 2019, nearly every Saturday in Paris was a scene of massive state repression. The world was shocked by French-style democracy, which uses indiscriminate tear gassings, rubber bullets, and violence against unarmed protesters while still claiming to be a beacon of political and human rights.
We were so numerous in the beginning, but when people began to see how violent and ferocious the government repressed the Yellow Vests, then many got too scared to protest. The government did everything they could to make us disappear, just so they can govern us according to their selfish whims.
The Yellow Vests' list of major demands are basically a call for an entire rethink of French politics, with everything from leaving the European Union, Eurozone, and NATO, to redistribution of France's enormous wealth, to green energy requiring open public debates and referendums. The Yellow Vests say they'll keep marching in the Saturdays to come, which may prove decisive during the presidential election in April. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Hezbollah held a funeral procession for three of the seven people who were killed by the far-right Lebanese Forces political party led by Samir Jaja. As the families of the victims awaited to bid their loved ones farewell, the slogans were those of grief and pious patience. One of the martyrs, Maryam Farhat, a mother of five, was shot in the head while she was in the comfort of her own home. Her sister says her blood will protect Lebanon from any sedition.
God bless her soul. She has made us proud. And may God give us and her children patience. I want to tell those that are sowing sedition in the country not to think about it too hard, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah will not allow it. He is the one safeguarding this country.
Hezbollah officials attended the funeral. The highlight of the event was a speech by head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashim Safiyyuddin, who directly accused the Lebanese Forces party of being behind the shootings.
The Lebanese Forces Party's acts are aimed at initiating a new civil war in Lebanon. This is not new for us. In the past, we warned against such plots without naming anyone. All this sectarian incitement and provocation in the media was only to drag people to internal fighting. Today, they have uncovered their true faces. His masters have hurriedly taken this step to drag the country to a civil war.
The master of the killers, he says, is the United States administration.
This is only one episode of the many episodes that are being orchestrated by the United States of America and is funded by some Arab countries. If you go back to the records of the Civil War, they all mention that the U.S. backs and pushes for such acts and Arab states fund it. They are repeating the same episode.
Sayed Safiyuddin said Hezbollah will not allow anyone to take Lebanon to the misery that the previous generations lived during the time of the civil war, while also calling for justice for the martyrs.
Hezbollah has buried the martyrs who fell in yesterday's shootings, and though the people have chanted that the blood of the innocent will not be in vain, the method of retaliation will not be by taking arms against fellow Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Education is considered a fundamental right in the 27-nation European Union, but questions are being raised around the effectiveness of school curriculums. The number of young people who find themselves without a job in the bloc is growing.
We look for jobs. It's very hard to find, especially in the pandemic, and a lot of people lost their jobs. So it's even harder now to find a job.
What do you think?
I think it's not only about jobs. We didn't go to university for 2 years. And people graduated from home. It's an event of a lifetime, and they didn't get to do it.
Nearly all my friends don't have jobs, and the ones who have are paid an absolute misery, because it's not only the having or not having a job, it's having a decent pay.
EU Jobs Commissioner Nicola Schmidt attended a meeting of EU employment ministers on Friday. During an online press conference following the meeting, we pointed out that youth unemployment was already out of control in several EU nations prior to the pandemic, namely in Greece, Spain and Italy. How confident can we be now that solutions can be found after the pandemic when we couldn't really find solutions before the pandemic?
Many sectors are desperately looking for skilled persons, for skilled people, and they do not find them. And this shows us that there are major mismatches on our labour market.
So the Commissioner believes reskilling for the digital age is the answer, but the European Commission has been talking about that now for almost a decade. Economists are saying official EU youth unemployment data at present is misleading. COVID-19 financial supports have been keeping jobs alive, but these government programmes are now being withdrawn. A potential tsunami of job losses is being forecast. The vast majority of those in precarious employment are young adults. Associated mental health issues and homelessness are big concerns. An EU social summit is scheduled for next Wednesday. Civil society organisations say the problems are well known. It's time, they say, to finally find solutions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Angry and grieved, Afghan expatriates in Iran gathered to mourn the loss of dozens of their fellow citizens who were killed in a deadly bomb attack on a Shia mosque in the Afghan province of Kunduz last Friday. Claimed by Daesh terrorists, the assault was the deadliest since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001.
I offer my condolences to my sad nation. We are all grieved for the loss of our fellow citizens. What wrong have they done? They were praying peacefully. The terrorists must be brought to justice.
The Taliban are accountable for what's happening. If they want to form a government, they must be able to ensure the security of our nation. Unfortunately, we heard that another terrorist attack was carried out today in another mosque. The Taliban must stop further terror attacks.
More than 150 people lost their lives in the attack at Ghuzar-e-Sayyadabad Mosque in the Khanabad area of Kunduz. A Daesh terrorist masquerading as a worshipper detonated his explosives during Friday prayers. The victims were all Hazara Shias, the third largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. something which is viewed as an attempt by Daesh to ethnically cleanse the country of Hazara Shia community.
The terrorists seek to eliminate the Shia population from Afghanistan. I wonder why the international community is silent about this massacre. Why is the West keeping mum?
Others see the bigger picture. They say the attack is masterminded by the U.S. as an attempt to push the war-ravaged country into yet another crisis after Washington's humiliating retreat from Afghanistan.
Certainly, the U.S. is behind